I don't feel like it's a modern thing. I think I was probably ghosted for the first time in, well, I don't know, 1994.
Really?
Yeah, I met a lovely guy. We had a slow dance at the disco and a bit of a kiss at the end. And, oh, 14-year-old me thought it was love and then never heard from him again.
Marginalia.
Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
In her novel, Ghosted, Rosie Walsh writes the story of an extremely capable woman who meets a man, spends an incredible week with him, makes future plans with him, and then he disappears. Initially, she believes something happened to him during his planned holiday, except through the marvels of social media, she can see when he's online and receives her texts, and when he starts to write back, and then stops. She's been ghosted, and she doesn't know why. I spoke with Rosie Walsh about her novel, her writing methods, and what's next. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Since I want readers to enjoy this novel as much as I did, I plan to avoid all spoilers, but we probably should set it up a bit. Ghosted is a novel about a woman named Sarah who meets a man named Eddie when she's traveled home to England for a visit. And she spends an incredible 7 days with him, and they plan to meet back up after he returns from a planned holiday. But she doesn't hear from him. Eddie doesn't reply to Sarah's texts or her voicemails or her social media messages or any other app that connects people. And this idea of being ghosted is very much a part of our culture right now, isn't it? Because we're not sure if she's being ghosted or if something has truly happened to him.
You know, I think ghosting's been part of our culture forever. I think it's just become a more obvious phenomenon these days, now that there's so many ways in which we can contact each other. I guess if somebody decides not to contact you, it's a lot harder to fool yourself now than it used to be, because even if they've lost their phone or your phone number, they'd still find you on Facebook or something, wouldn't they? Like, it's, I don't feel like it's a modern thing. I think I was probably ghosted for the first time in, well, I don't know, 1994.
Really?
Yeah, I met a lovely guy. We had a slow dance at the disco and a bit of a kiss at the end. And, oh, 14-year-old me thought it was love and then never heard from him again. And I guess then it was a lot easier to convince myself that he'd just, you know, collapsed and died somewhere, which was obviously unlikely. whereas now it would take a far greater feat of self-deception, I think, to convince myself that he was dead. Because he could find me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, or, you know, there's always a way of tracking somebody down these days.
And as you mentioned in the book, you can see when somebody reads your message or receives your message, or if they start to write back and then they stop. Oh, that it was just gut-wrenching at times.
It is, and I think that's a testament to the intensity of the emotions that people experience when they're ghosted. I don't think, you know, I think most people are fairly sane when it comes to matters of the heart. But when you see somebody wholly convinced that the object of their affections has, you know, has just broken their phone or maybe had a bad accident or something, it's quite mind-blowing, really, because, you know, as an objective observer, it's very obvious that they just haven't called you, and you know, you know perfectly well they would have a million ways of getting hold of this person otherwise. But there's something about the shock of thinking that you really have met the one and then hearing absolutely nothing that I think just sends us crazy.
And it's my understanding that you got this idea from a friend of yours who was ghosted, and just like your main character, she was just this perfectly capable woman.
Yes. So I decided to write Ghosted the night that I had dinner with a friend who, yeah, was, you know, a sane, intelligent, capable woman, you know, also beautiful and successful and funny, but, you know, that's kind of by the by. She'd been seeing a man for a short while, but it was going very well. He seemed incredibly keen. They talked about going on holiday together, and then he completely disappeared. And as we sat there across the dinner table, she was running through all the things that might have happened to him and all the reasons why he might have called. It was completely impossible for her to comprehend that he just, you know, had ghosted her, even though she would have, of course, seen her friends go through that. And I just felt so furious at this really very intelligent woman, you know, who has a very high-powered career, and had many relationships in her life. You know, she wasn't desperate. Could nonetheless convince herself that some terrible fate had befallen this man simply because he hadn't called her. And that's because it was so unexpected.
So this book is very much about love and loss and heartbreak. And as I mentioned, sometimes it was gut-wrenching, you know, for this reader anyway. Was it emotionally difficult to write?
Yes. I mean, my writing process involves many, many layers. And it's often and not until I've really, really polished a scene many times that I can begin to feel the emotional truth of it. And that's when I'll have a real cry. So many of the research conversations that I had about mental health, for example, without wishing to give too much away, there's a character that we meet at a stage in the novel who has had very isolating mental health problems that have been going on for decades. I found that really tough, actually, sort of listening to people's experiences, both mental health professionals and patients themselves, and how a life can be so full and so lived and then be reduced to a room. I found that really hard. I found Sarah's emotional journey, once we actually discover why Eddie didn't call, it's quite an emotional journey, that one. And yeah, I found that quite emotional. But I think for me, I tend not to get really sad reading my own words until the very end when it's all really polished, because that's when all the layers are put in, that's when I really feel I can sort of engage with what they're going through.
One of the main characters in the book, Sarah, has started a charity in Los Angeles named Clown Docs. I know the book is fiction, but is there any truth to that organization?
Clown doctor charities exist all over the world, actually. They're not something I knew about before I started writing this. I knew that I wanted Sarah to work in the nonprofit sector. And I knew that it would be something involving children and probably, you know, children and health. And so I started looking vaguely at hospital entertainers because I didn't really know where to start. And that didn't quite feel right. But I soon stumbled upon Clown Doctors. They were started in the States, in New York, in the 80s, I think the first Clown Doctors came. And it's become a thing that's available all over the world now for sick children. Clown doctors will visit hospitals, respite homes, hospices, special needs schools, any kind of setting in which a child is having a difficult time. And I think what they do is absolutely extraordinary. And the way it works is so clever, because the clown doctors are basically the fools, and these poor children who, whatever they're going through, tend to find themselves in a situation where their life has got out of control. There's normally a doctor who's in charge of their body and their decisions, or their parents have taken over. You know, normally the children feel like they've very much become a sort of low status person. Suddenly they're in a room with a clown doctor who's trained to make them feel immediately like they're the highest status person. So the clown doctor is, you know, the fool, the silly person, and the children get to laugh at them and just for once to tell somebody else what to do and to take control of a situation. And I've seen it in action, and it's just mind-blowing, actually, the difference that even a short visit from a trained clown doctor can make to a child who's in hospital or somewhere like that. I almost abandoned the book to just run off with a clown doctor charity. I thought what they do was so fantastic.
I read that when writing this book, you didn't know how to finish it, and in fact, tried several different endings. How did you know when you finally got it right, that when you finally had that wow novel your editor knew you had in you?
That's a very good question. I think the way I write is slightly unusual. Most writers I know have a method, and you know, they've done a lot of reading about creative writing, and I don't. I just work solely with my gut. So that's the best answer I can give you, really. I just know. When it's done, I know. And, you know, that's not to say I don't hand it in many times before that to my editor going, yeah, I think I've got it, knowing full well, you know, deep in my heart that I haven't. But when it's right, I know that I'm not going to see the novel again, apart from, you know, the kind of final editing stages, copy editing and proofreading and so on. And that's when I'll probably get a bit emotional and have a bit of a cry over my characters and my story. And when I handed in the final draft of this, I just knew. And that was when I sort of looked at the story as a whole and thought, oh gosh, I'm so proud of this. And I hadn't quite felt that for the year that I'd spent editing it until that point. It just wasn't quite there.
I read on your website that you're a fan of the Pomodoro method.
Mm.
How do you incorporate it into your life?
I use a Pomodoro technique for almost everything. Well, actually, I say I use it for almost everything. That's my aim. When I don't use it for everything, I find that my life spirals quickly out of control. For me, I'm not somebody whose life is full of routine. However, just having that time boundary, knowing that I only need to spend 25 minutes on anything before I can have a break, makes anything feel achievable. So certainly for writing, you know, if I'm writing a passage or a chapter that feels completely overwhelming and unwritable, you know, I know that the longest I've got to go will be 24 minutes and 59 seconds. And hopefully it'll be about 12 minutes by the stage I start, by the time I start feeling that. And that's the same with, you know, whether it's housework or sorting out a problem with insurance or, you know, anything like that. I just find if I break jobs down into little manageable chunks, everything's easy.
I was also a bit intrigued by your use of post-it notes to plan out your novel.
Yeah, I learned about post-it notes from an American author friend of mine, Julie Cohen, and I used them to such brilliant effect with Ghosted. With my new novel, I just can't seem to find a way of using them. I think that means I haven't fleshed out my ideas quite enough. But generally, I will use yellow post-it notes for the main plot and then blue for, say, flashbacks. Pink for character development, green for just lovely phrases that I just happen to have thought of and don't want to forget, and orange for red herrings. And it just worked really well, actually. I found Ghosted, my first draft, really easy to write because I had everything just planned out really nicely and neatly, and it all made sense, and I was able to see, you know, it's been a while since I had a blue note or a green note, and I probably need to put an orange note in here. And I find it really calming, actually, writing that way, which is probably why the novel that I'm writing at the moment is not feeling very calm.
So the novel that you're writing right now, are you willing to talk about it, or are you an author who would rather not until it's further along?
No, I can talk about it, but it, you know, it may well change. I've only written a few thousand words. It's about a man who's writing his wife's obituary. His wife is still alive, but due to some fairly scary health problems, he has started writing her obituary because that's what he does for a living. And in so doing, discovers that his wife is not who he thought she was. And so the novel is about him trying to find out exactly who his wife is and why she's kept so many secrets from him for so long.
That sounds incredible. but back to Ghosted, though, I have another question about setting. Can you talk to me a little bit about where the novel is set? Is that where you're from?
So the novel is set in a little valley in Gloucestershire in the UK. It's in a designated area of outstanding natural beauty called the Cotswolds. It's roughly where I grew up. I didn't grow up in that valley, but my best friend did. And I spent a lot of time at her house there, both as a child and an adult. And there's always been something about that valley, and I think that comes out in the writing, that feels incredibly special to me and unlike anywhere else I know. It does feel like a valley that's full of secrets. It's not somewhere that you'd be likely to find, even if you were driving, because there's no roads that run along it. It's a footpath only. There's roads that cross it from time to time, but they're tiny country lanes. So it's basically a secret valley. And I could not stop visiting when I was writing. I visited, I'd say upwards of 30, 40 times over the course of about 18 months. And I would go with my notebook and I'd note down different bird songs, different smells, you know, what flowers were in the hedgerows, what flowers were in the meadows, what the trees looked and sounded like. I even went and slept without a tent in a field down there one night with my boyfriend, just so I could really feel what it's like in that opening chapter when Sarah and Eddie are lying outside under a darkening sky in that valley. It was such a beautiful night, actually. I'll never forget it. Just those sounds all night of a very secret cut-off valley. So, yeah, it was quite an epic job just doing the location research alone. But I think that's because the location is almost a character in the book itself, so to speak. It, you know, almost has a personality. It's almost as much a part of the love story as Sarah and Eddie.
Now, I have to tell you, I really thought I knew where the story was going, but you got me. You caught me completely by surprise. So,
good.
Well done.
I don't think, because various editors in countries around the world have bought it, and not one single one of them managed to spot the twist. And I sort of think that's their job. So if I fooled them, then I was onto a winner, I think.
That was Rosie Walsh, author of the novel Ghosted, which was published by Pamela Dorman Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. You can discover new episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.